Today on Maine Calling, Maine's ambivalent role in the abolition movement. In Maine today, you can visit sites believed to have been part of the Underground Railroad. In Brewer's Chamberlain Park, a statue depicts a man who has recently escaped from slavery, emerging from a tunnel. In Westbrook, a plaque pays tribute to four city leaders who provided safe houses. In Portland, there's the Freedom Trail. Mainers may be proud of the state's role in the Underground Railroad and in the abolition movement overall, but there is a lot more to the story. In fact, many, if not most, Mainers in the 1800s did not oppose slavery. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will delve into this complicated history. What was Maine's role in the abolition movement, and how were the anti-slavery leaders viewed by others? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today we discuss the period in Maine's history before the abolition of slavery nationwide. It is filled with conflicting attitudes and actions in Maine, and we're going to delve into this history with Dr. Mary Freeman, who's Assistant Professor of New England History at the University of Maine. Her focus is the history of slavery and emancipation. Bob Green, a retired journalist, eighth-generation Mainer, and an expert in Maine's Black history, and Dr. Patrick Rail, professor of history at Bowdoin College. His most recent book is 88 Years, The Long Death of Slavery in the United States. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about Maine's role in abolition? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you, and welcome back, Bob. Bob, I'll start with you. We know that there were enslaved people in what was then the District of Maine during the colonial era. In fact, the 1754 census shows approximately 154 enslaved men and women. But slavery was outlawed in 1783, and I think many people believe that's the end of the story. It's not, is it? Maine's economy was dependent on slavery well into the 1800s, and I'm hoping you can explain how slavery and Maine's economy continued to be intertwined during that time period.
It is quite interesting because actually the latest I find slaves in Maine is 1820. The 1820 census lists 10 slaves living in Bristol, Maine. By 1830, they're listed as being free. But that was the reason Maine was a main player in the world, or especially in the United States. And a lot of the work done here, we know about the South, but a lot of the work done was done by Black folks here in Maine, too. And that was the reason that they were brought in.
Yeah. And Patrick, Professor Rail, a big part of the economy was shipbuilding. These ships were used in the slave trade. And also we think about all the mills in Maine, and the cotton had to come from somewhere. Can you sort of characterize the dependence of Maine and New England on slavery in the South?
The interesting thing about this period in American history is that while the northern states were ending slavery and replacing their former forms of economic organization with this sort of nascent industrialization, the beginnings of manufacturing, ironically, that sort of spurred the growth of slavery in the southern states, because it was in those southern states that the cotton was grown, that the northern mills of Maine and Massachusetts and other states were turning into cloth. That was the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution in America. And Maine's economy was tightly linked through the maritime trades with the Southern economy. So Southern cotton would come to the Northern states like Maine. It would be turned into cloth, and then in many instances sold back to the Southern states, sometimes to clothe those actual enslaved people. So this is the real tension in 19th century American history, is between this one half of the country that was moving toward a free labor economy that was still dependent on slavery, and the other half where slavery actually was enhanced by the growth of a, quote, free labor economy in the Northern states.
Mary, in 1783, when slavery was outlawed in what was then Massachusetts, what was the attitude, and what do we know about the attitude of most people who lived in Maine then?
Yeah, well, as Patrick has already said, the maritime economy that was, you know, prevalent in most of coastal New England, including Maine at that time, meant that a lot of people had a lot of money tied up in the institution of slavery, whether that be in the growing cotton economy in the southern part of the new United States at that time period, or the West Indies, where sugar plantations were generating enormous amounts of wealth through enslaved labor that was fueling, you know, some of the richest families who were, you know, the merchants who owned the ships that were engaged in the coasting trade going down the coast of the U.S. to the West Indies. So basically in 1783, you have this really interesting moment where we've just fought a revolution over ideas of liberty, democracy, equality, and you have a nascent anti-slavery movement, but you also have a lot of wealth, especially in New England, that's very tied into the economy of slavery, which means a lot of people are, you know, torn on this issue, but a lot of people are still, you know, very reluctant to embrace any kind of anti-slavery attitude.
We'll go to Ron, who's calling from York. Hi, Ron, go ahead.
Yes, I belong to a group called Woke York, which is primarily myself and Kevin Freeman, who's an artist and a sign maker. And we have a group of local historians and botanists, biologists, whatever, just to discuss the past history of York. And in it, we've done an extensive research on the upper parish and the amount of slavery in the upper parish. We think that York is probably the largest slaveholding municipality in the state of Maine in the early colonial period. We've got roughly a list of close to 50 slaves already, the names and the owners. We've researched probate records because they're listed in probate, different diaries and stuff. And we even noticed that the town of York purchased two slaves for their minister, the Reverend Samuel Moody. And he didn't like one of the slaves. He thought it was lazy. So the town sold that one, went to Newburyport, and bought another one. And that seems to have satisfied the minister.
Ron, but let me ask you this, because if you've done this research, which is very interesting, we're talking about the period after 1783 and, of course, before the Civil War. What do you know about the attitude?
I'm going to get to that in about a second.
Okay, go ahead.
Evidently, I don't know why, our family had some type of a unique relationship with the slaves, and I don't know what it is, but it went to such an extent that our family created a specific slave cemetery, and there's 12 to 16 slaves in that slave cemetery, which I think is probably the largest one in the state of Maine. After they ran out of room in the second parish cemetery where the Nowells were buried, they started burying white members of the fourth and fifth generations in the slave cemetery next to it. And in the middle of the slave cemetery is one white Nowell from the third generation who was sort of a financial scallywag. And they didn't put him in the family cemetery where the first three are. They put him in the middle of the slave cemetery with just a plain stone. his grandchildren found out that that's where he was. They took the plain stone out, and they had a white marble stone made, and that sets right in amongst all the stones of the slaves. I have the names of all the slaves. I don't know which grave is which. I do know that one of them is a Native American woman, and she sets up front all by herself. There's also two indentured servants in that cemetery. So rather than burying them outside the cemetery, which seems to have been the course in the upper parish, most of the slaves are outside, the Nowells created their own slave cemetery. And it's a beautiful place. And they did it on a bank up above a brook, and it's beautiful.
Ron, thank you for adding to that. Is that something that people can go see? Is it accessible?
Yes, it is. It's very, very accessible. And I just finished mowing it yesterday. So it's all...
And how do they find it? Where is it located?
It is located on almost at the intersection of the Linscott Road and Mill Lane. You start up Mill Lane from Route 91 in York. You go up Mill Lane about a mile, and the Linscott Road is on the right. And you just as soon as you drive to the top of the knoll, there's a big, huge, brand-new driveway running down over the hill. And if you look right in the woods right there, you can see the white marble stones. So it's near the edge of the road, and it's just off from that new driveway. If you pull in the edge of the new driveway and you look to your left, you'll be able to see the cemetery.
All right. Well, Ron, thank you so much for calling in and joining into the conversation. Bob, in places like York, what happened in 1783? Were people, did they continue to work where they worked and were paid for it? Did they leave? Or was the law ignored? Bob Green, do you know?
I don't know, to be honest about it. I will say this, is that you don't find a large number of blacks migrating anywhere. But then you don't find a large number of blacks being anywhere at one time in the state of Maine outside of the two or three centers. So it's difficult to find out exactly what happened, except for one thing we do know. Is that all blacks, just like almost everybody else in this state, came here for jobs. And when there were no more, when the jobs went, so did the people.
Patrick Rail.
Yeah, this moment of transition from slavery to freedom in these states was really kind of complicated in a lot of ways. We sort of tend to think about cotton slavery gone with the wind, enormous numbers of enslaved people concentrated on populations. But in New England, African-Americans, enslaved African-Americans were dispersed very broadly among the population. They often were involved in domestic servitude, household servitude, rather than agricultural production. They might work as teamsters in cities and things like this, where they had a considerable amount of freedom. So the actual edges between slavery and freedom relative to, I think, how we would think of it, we're sort of porous. And we're talking about a time when servitude for white laborers was just sort of ending, when apprenticeship for younger people was still a thing. So in many of these instances, especially when slavery ended in more gradual kinds of fashions, you see these negotiations between the enslaved and the enslavers, as the enslaver had an interest in getting as much compelled labor out of their workers as possible. And the workers themselves had an interest in easing their transition to freedom. So I think that notion of, so sometimes for an individual person, your legal status might change, but your actual labor relationship might remain fairly similar.
Mm-hmm. I want to fast forward from 1783 to 1820, Mary, the creation of the state of Maine, and it is so tied into the abolition movement, and it so illustrates the ambivalence, the difficulty in talking about this time. Maine came into the state as part of the Missouri Compromise. For those who need a little bit of a history lesson, explain that.
Sure. So I'm a big advocate of trying to push for the Maine-Missouri Compromise to get Maine back in there rather than just the Missouri Compromise, because Maine is essential to the story. Maine voted many times leading up to 1820 to decide whether or not to separate from Massachusetts. That's a whole other story in its own that we could go into. But eventually, Maine did decisively vote. Maine voters voted decisively in 1819 to separate from Massachusetts. Where things got complicated was that at that time, Missouri was the first state to be carved out of the Louisiana Territory in the West that had been acquired by the federal government back in 1800. So Missouri was petitioning Congress also in 1819 to become a state with slavery legal in the state constitution. Suddenly, Maine comes in also in 1819 and says, hey, we also want to become an independent state. Mainers at that time hadn't really seen themselves as connected to Missouri out west, but Congress saw an opportunity. They saw that this was going to be a problem. If Missouri wanted to come in as a slaveholding state, that would upset the balance of power in Congress between so-called free states and slaveholding states. So when Maine asked to come in as well, Congress saw an opportunity to maintain that balance. And, you know, that resulted in what we think of as the Missouri Compromise, but was actually, in my mind, the Maine-Missouri Compromise. And Mainers had some really mixed reactions. A lot of people in Maine, even though they had decisively voted to separate from Massachusetts and become an independent state, they did not like the idea of their statehood being tied to the expansion of slavery out into the new Western territories being carved out of the Louisiana Territory.
And Mary, so my understanding is that even the District of Maine's representatives to Congress were very conflicted and and had a hard time deciding how to vote. Can you talk about that? The representatives... would you say that Maine's representatives to Congress in 1820, or the District of Maine's, were indeed opposed to slavery? Or the expansion, expansion of slavery, excuse me.
It is, that's a tricky question. So Maine at that time had seven congressmen, actually. So we had more people in the House of Representatives than we do now. And of those seven, five of them voted in favor of the Missouri Compromise. Two of them voted against it. And in the House of Representatives, the vote was extremely close. It was 90 to 87, 90 in favor, 87 against. So even if just two of those main congressmen had changed their vote, had voted against the compromise, it would have gone the other way. And the congressmen in Maine were conflicted. They, you know, again, Maine voters had decisively said, we want to separate from Massachusetts. But there was this feeling that, you know, while there was a division between wanting to compromise to maintain this kind of balance of power in the Senate and the House of Representatives between free and slaveholding states, you know, represented in Congress. But there's also the feeling that, you know, by allowing slavery to expand into this Western territory, that this set a dangerous precedent. And that proved to be very true, you know, that the compromise in 1820 settled things sort of for the time being. But this conflict kept coming up again and again as the U.S. territorial boundaries continued to expand. And then, of course, the Civil War in 1861 you know, swept the whole country up into a very bloody war fought over the issue of slavery.
Well, we're talking about abolition and the anti-slavery movement in Maine, but we have so much more to get to. Oh my goodness, we have not talked about the Underground Railroad. We have not talked about Harriet Beecher Stowe. We have not talked about the Portland Anti-Slavery Society. So we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we'll talk about those topics. This is Maine Calling. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're learning about the complicated history of Maine's involvement with the abolition movement, a chapter in Maine's history that held many contradictions. My guest today, Bob Green, who is a journalist for several decades and has done extensive research on Maine's Black history. Dr. Patrick Rail is with Bowdoin College. He's a professor of history who specializes in African American history in the Civil War era. And Dr. Mary Freeman is with UMaine. She's assistant professor of New England history, focused on slavery and emancipation. We invite you to join the conversation. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Patrick, I got the sense before the break you wanted to jump in and had something to add, but I went right to the break. So go ahead now. We were talking about the Missouri Compromise, Maine's role in it, and Maine's feelings about slavery at this moment in time when Maine was becoming a state.
Yes, there's so much history here to talk about. But one thing about the Maine-Missouri Compromise, I think that bears mentioning, is that when Missouri was coming in, or when Congress was considering Missouri to come in, there was a measure that was proposed that would have banned any future slavery in Missouri. It was called the Crittenden Compromise. And it became kind of a litmus test throughout the country on this issue. Five of Maine's seven congressmen voted for this compromise. In other words, they were saying, sure, Missouri can come in, but it can't come in as a slave state forever. And that failed. Missouri did come in as a slave state. So there are folks who can think about Maine's entering the country as a free state, as an independent state, as kind of a cost. It was almost as if we expanded slavery in Missouri, or Maine's independence came at the cost of expanding slavery westward into Missouri.
Bob, I want to talk to you about the Underground Railroad. In the past couple decades, a couple of monuments have been erected in Brewer and in Westbrook. And of course, we know about the Portland Freedom Trail. When was the Underground Railroad active in Maine? What do we know about how extensive it was?
That's a very unusual question. And you hear it all the time. But remember this, the Underground Railroad, in order to be successful, had to be secret. So no one wrote down anything or published anything on it. And so nobody really knows for sure exactly where it was or what it was. And that was the way it was able to survive. We know now of there probably are more places that were stops on the Underground Railroad now than probably existed during the time.
Do we have a sense of, was this for decades, or was this, do we have any sense of what years folks were sheltering people who had escaped from slavery, or do we not even know that?
We really don't. I mean, we have, every so often you'll hear, we do have stories about people coming escaped or enslaved people showing up in Portland, for example, on ships that were taken off and sent on to Canada. We have stories about the Avery family down in Waterboro, having people work on building stone walls. We have the slave shirt being found in when a house was demolished up in Brewer. But how many of these? Where are they? We do know that they did come. and they passed through Maine, and some stayed in Maine. But thanks to no records, we can't prove exactly anything much.
There's so much sort of lore around the Underground Railroad. It is has such a mystique around it. And I think a lot of our popular understandings of it are about Quakers along the Ohio River and highly organized campaigns and routes and perhaps even underground tunnels and things. I think it's really important to understand that what we're really talking about is helping fugitives, helping people who have fled slavery. And that has happened since the beginning of slavery, right? There have always been people who are trying to flee the institution. Once New England becomes free, that becomes a place where they obviously want to go, but ultimately you have to leave the country if you want permanent freedom because this is a slave country. The Constitution acknowledges the legitimacy of slavery. So the first real, if we want to call it underground railroad organizations were African Americans. There were African Americans working in community, often in these maritime cities like Bath or Portland, to help secret others around. In New York City, they were called vigilance committees. So I think it's important to nuance our understanding of what this activity was about. A lot of it was highly informal. And it depended on the maritime economy where movement was more easy and more possible to be secret.
All right. Mary, we know that in 1833 something was formed called the Portland Anti-Slavery Society. What can you tell us about that? Who was a part of that? How mainstream or fringe was it considered?
Yeah, so the early 1830s was when a number of both local, statewide, and also national anti-slavery organizations were formed. And this is sort of the moment where anti-slavery abolitionist activism really prioritizes an immediate end to slavery, not a gradual emancipation. And they also start to prioritize arguing for racial equality for Black Americans alongside an immediate end to slavery. So this is a more radical stance than prior organizations had taken. And a lot of it was driven, kind of echoing what Patrick just said, was driven by the pre-existing activist networks and commitments of Black activists. And that was true in Maine, as well as in places throughout the Northeast. So in Maine, the Portland Anti-Slavery Society being founded in 1833 kind of signals a moment where, abolition was already in Maine, but it was mostly something that was embraced and advocated for by Black Mainers. So I know Bob has done a lot of research on this topic related to the founding of the Abyssinian Meeting House in Portland, which dates back to the late 1820s. A pretty robust, thriving community of Black Portlanders and Black Mainers in maritime communities who started kind of putting abolition on the table, and mostly were only, being heard within their own communities. What starts to change in the early 1830s is that a small minority of white Mainers starts to listen and starts to join in. And that's happening throughout New England, throughout the Northeast, where white activists start joining Black activists and creating organizations that are interracial, that are Black and white activists working together. And the movement starts gaining more visibility on a local and a national level.
Bob, my understanding is the Anti-Slavery Society was not allowed to meet in a lot of places, including Portland City Hall, that they were shunned.
That's true. But as was pointed out, it was basically, it started off basically as a Black organization, primarily Black, not completely. But the first president, by the way, was my four-time great grandfather, Christopher Christian Emanuel, who was from the born in the Caribbean, came to Maine around 1800. Interestingly, he was a barber. And I say interestingly because elected secretary of this of the society at the same time was another black barber, Jacob Dixon. So as you can see, barbering was pretty big in the black community and in all throughout Maine. And they were very strong in the abolitionist movement.
How influential was the abolitionist movement in Maine?
It started off slow, but it became the main thing in the state. Even Samuel Fessenden, at first he was he believed in a group that wanted to send free blacks to Africa and get them out of the out of this country. But once he heard the abolitionist movement, he joined completely and was very strong in it, along with his sons. And there were a lot of other folks. Reuben Ruby, who, by the way, was Christopher Christian Manuel's brother-in-law, was probably the biggest black abolitionist in the state, the most important one. And he participated in the Maine, in forming the Maine Anti-Slavery Society, and he was elected to leadership roles in several national black abolitionist groups. But there were others, including, like, for example, Henry Gloucester of Sanford, who was a general agent for Maine's Daughters of Freedom, a openly political anti-slavery and temperance organization. And that's the other thing that we really don't talk about that much, is that the anti-slavery movement, the temperance movement, and the women's movement were all part and parcel together. They were the same people were pushing all three events.
Patrick, I know you want to jump in because this is what you've really studied in depth. Yeah. This is how people's hearts and minds were changed. Would you characterize what Bob is talking about, what happened with Samuel Fessenden, this resistance at first, but then building toward acceptance as, you know, in the years between 1833 and the Civil War in Maine, as typical or at least not unusual, that more and more people began to, I guess the word would be, become enlightened and join?
Yeah, it's a tremendously important moment that we're talking about here. The consistent piece is African-American organizing, which is there throughout. African-Americans working in community to support each other and to support the enslaved to become free. What's new in the early 1830s is this focus by originally a handful of religious reformers. They're begin in Boston around the figure of William Lloyd Garrison, who launches The Liberator, his abolitionist newspaper, on January 1st, 1831. What this movement means is that for the first time, African-Americans have white allies clearly on their side. The flavor of white abolitionism, if you could even call it that up to now, was gradualism. We're going to seek to gradually end slavery. We'll compensate the slaveholders. And since we can't have a multiracial society, those emancipated will be, quote, returned to Africa, even though they were born here. What we get in the early 1830s is this new strident flavor of radical abolitionism or immediatism, which, as Professor Freeman was saying, was about the immediate and uncompensated end to slavery because it is a national sin that we are engaging in. So suddenly we have on African-American side handfuls of white allies who have The capacity to organize, speak in public without the same kinds of threats. Sometimes they have money, like Arthur and Louis Tappan or Jared Smith in New York, who funded the abolitionist movement, broadcast the message far and wide. The critical thing to remember, though, is that none of those white allies would have been on board if African Americans themselves hadn't been telling them that they needed to be.
And Patrick, I mentioned Harriet Beecher Stowe. I'm going to go back to you because you teach at Bowdoin. Harriet Beecher Stowe's husband was working at Bowdoin when she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Talk about the significance of that book and the significance that she wrote it while in Maine. And also, I understand that she was part of a group of people, a salon, if you will, that worked together to promote abolition.
Yes, she wrote probably the most important novel of the 19th century, if not American history. When Abraham Lincoln met her, he said, oh, so you're the little woman who started this great big war. She was moved to write Uncle Tom's Cabin. That sort of story goes that she's sitting in the First Parish Church in Brunswick, listening to the Reverend Adams give a sermon on the evils of the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, which had just passed and made it much harder to protect fugitive slaves in northern states. And so she's listening to this sermon and she has this epiphany. She has this vision of a moment of an elderly enslaved man dying under the lash of an enslaver. That would be Simon Legree in Uncle Tom's Cabin. She goes to her home on Federal Street and begins writing it up in serial form. So it came out in chapters in an abolitionist newspaper called the National Era. So here is somebody who is in a state that is as far away from slavery as possible, yet she takes it upon herself to speak for the enslaved. And she writes a book that is really in many ways a fictionalized version of the slave narratives that enslaved people who fled to freedom had been writing and publishing themselves, people like Frederick Douglass. But her book becomes a huge bestseller, and it does that work of, we were talking about Fessenden and his sort of conversion to abolition. She's inviting people to, white people in the North, particularly white women who were pious, to convert to abolitionism, to understand the plight of the enslaved as their own, to understand the position of enslaved mothers who would be separated from their children, enslaved families who would be divided by sale. And so the book has this enormous impact in doing that work of broadcasting the message and hopefully creating converts.
I need to go to another break. This is all so interesting. We're talking about Maine's role in the abolition movement. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. How did Maine make the long transition from slavery to emancipation? Joining me, Patrick Rail, who is a Bowdoin history professor, Mary Freeman, assistant professor of New England history at the University of Maine, and Bob Green, Maine historian and retired journalist. You can share your comments and questions if you're quick. An email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Kitsy calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. This is such a fabulous program. I'm so glad you had it. I wanted to do two things. One, I want to honor my former husband, Wells Staley Mays, who currently is at the Barron Center, and he's bedridden. But he is really the first person who started researching some of the sites that would become part of the Freedom Trail. He was himself an activist and a historian. And the second part is one of my ministries was 2 years at First Parish Unitarian Universalist as a consulting minister among a team of ministers at that time. And I remember the story of when during this time they did have an abolitionist speaker in the pulpit at First Parish. And at a certain point, a number of people who clearly were anti-abolition started moving up toward the pulpit with no good intentions. And a number of women and perhaps some men said, get over to the window, get over to the window. And he jumped down from the pulpit and went over to the window. They broke it, and he got out. And a number, primarily of women, circled him to protect him from the anti-abolitionist members and friends of First Parish. And when I served there and heard that history, I mean, I was appalled, you know. I mean, I was so ignorant. What did I know? Well, I did know something by then. But anyway, that was part of First Parish Unitarian Universalist history. And the point is there were many people who opposed abolition. Thanks,
Kitsy,
Jen,
thank you so much for calling in. Patrick has been nodding the whole time you've been talking. You know the story, Patrick.
Well, it just resonates because, excuse me, the point here that I take is to understand that to be an abolitionist at this time was really to take your life in your hands. It was to become an outsider, to become a pariah. Overwhelmingly, the public rejected abolitionism in the 1830s. There were riots in Philadelphia and New York City over abolitionists. William Lloyd Garrison in Boston was attacked while publicly speaking and dragged through the streets on the end of a rope. He was almost tarred and feathered if the Boston police hadn't locked him up for his own safety. So I asked my students this when we start this work: would you have been an abolitionist? Would you have identified yourself with this movement? It's very easy today to look back and, of course, say, yes, we should all have been abolitionists back then. But back then, the normal position was not to do that.
Kitsy, thank you so much for your call. We'll go to Dan calling from Portland. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing? I'm calling because about 2016, I bought this house on State Street. And come to find out, it was, it's called the Winslow Holmes House. And one of them, I can't remember which of the two guys, was the very first Superior Court judge of the state of Maine. In 1836, when Falmouth broke off the Peninsula of Portland and made it the first capital, he was the first Superior Court judge of Maine at the new capital, and built my house as basically a hunting camp. It was the fourth house. You could see all the oceans, and you could see the ocean and all the mountains. And the top two floors were never finished off. And I believe it was part of the Underground Railroad from the people who sold me the house. And in one of the walls, I found in between the lats some long bones, like rabbit bones and chicken bones, stuff like that, that somebody had eaten. And instead of throwing it out the window, they hid it in the wall, because if it was out the window and on the ground, I'm assuming it might have been because they thought they would have got caught. So I have a couple questions. One, does that sound true to anybody? Two, is that part of the Underground Railroad is that if you were slave friendly, you would paint the top of your chimney black. And it was a way to let people know that people who were trying to get to Canada, that was a place that they would take you in. And the other thing is that the other guys who bought the house after the Superior Court judge were the two guys from Austria who started commercial canning in downtown Portland. And I believe Percival Baxter's dad was also into canning. And the reason why I asked was if it was, then he was at my house at some time at point. Hmm. So that's my question.
Bob Green, I see you nodding and grinning as you listen to Dan's story. These are the kind of stories that are brought to you all the time, correct?
All the time. And these are all the rumors we don't know. And I can't answer the bone story. They sound great, but I can't deny them either. It's part of that lore of the Underground Railroad.
What he said about painting the top of your chimney black? Had you heard that before?
I've heard it. I can't tell you if it's true or not, but I've heard that. There are other things that we've heard over the years. One of the things I would like to go back about, Maine was not alone in all of this. And it's when you start looking, it brings the whole national thing into being. Harriet Beecher Stowe's younger brother was a minister, the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher. And he was the minister of a church in Brooklyn Heights, New York, the Plymouth Church. And it was he who had a group of young college students come and sing at that ch at his church that created enough money for the Fisk what is now Fisk University to continue. He also was considered one of the people that pressured President Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. So we talk about Maine, but Maine was a leader. There's a reason why our motto is Dirigo, I lead. And there's a reason why the old saying was, as Maine goes, so goes the nation.
Dan, thank you for your call. Mary, before we run out of time, I have to ask you about the letters you've been researching and learning from. Tell us about that.
Sure. So one of my research projects has been to look into letter writing as a major means of abolitionist organizing and kind of generating their platform. So, you know, as has come up a few times in this conversation, it was quite dangerous and quite radical to be an abolitionist in the period all the way up to the Civil War. So a lot of the, you know, and it kind of goes back to this conversation about the Underground Railroad as well. Sometimes the truth is stranger than fiction, I guess I would say, to be really pithy about it. But, you know, a lot of the communication that activists had to happen as covertly and privately as possible. So actually painting a chimney might be a little bit too bold almost.
Too obvious.
So, yeah, too obvious. So it would be more useful for abolitionists to rely on more secure forms of communication. So I've looked at letter writing from a lot of different angles. And you can think about it as paralleling in some ways conversations we've had in recent years about how effective social media activism is. It can be a really wonderful, open, democratic means of reaching fellow supporters of a particular cause. But there can also be a lot of dangers of surveillance and repression and censorship as well. Abolitionists face a lot of those dilemmas also, that letters could be a really secure means of communicating, especially in dangerous situations, sometimes involving the movement of fugitive slaves from one place to another. But at the same time, there was always a risk that the contents of letters could be exposed. So I look at letters as an essential part of abolitionist organizing that until this point people have not really thought of as quite as crucial to, you know, uniting this really geographically disparate, scattered movement that encompassed people from all different walks of life. But, you know, many of them were readers and writers. Even people who were just learning how to read and write were really committed to getting their words on paper and communicating. So it's a really fascinating window into this really complex movement.
Fascinating. I look forward to hearing more about that. I think we have time to go to Jean from South Portland. Jean, I know you have a story to tell, and I'm going to ask you to tell it quickly.
I'm going to tell it very quickly. One thing that's little known is that the founder of Bates, Orrin Chaney, was a Free Will Baptist. Which, and all Free Will Baptists in Maine were also believed they were abolitionists. And Chaney felt that once we've spoken against slavery, we now have an obligation to educate them. And the long story short, he founded with the other Free Will Baptists at great cost the first school for freed slaves in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. It was known as Storer College because of a donor from Springfield, John Storer, and it lasted for 100 years. And Chaney went to Fessenden, they went to Congress and asked for it. Harper's Ferry was a federal arsenal, and they didn't know what to do with the land, and Chaney asked for all of it. And he got a good portion of it. And if you're in Harper's Ferry, you'll see the word Storer. This building was part of Storer College. And that is a Mainer.
Well, Jean, thank you so much for that story. We're almost out of time, but I just want to go to this email from Carol for you, Patrick. She writes, 5 of 7 Maine congressmen voted against the Missouri Compromise, not for it. And you, and I know that's not what you were saying. You were saying that there was another, before the actual Missouri Compromise, there was another bill before Congress and that would have, and just really quickly wrap that up again. To clarify,
yeah, the measure that they 5 of 7 voted against was a measure, an amendment to the Missouri bill that said Missouri could come in, but only as a free state.
Voted for that one.
That's right. But it didn't pass. And so then they wound up voting for Maine statehood.
Great. Just wanted to clarify, because if Carol was confused, I'm sure there were some other people confused. And I want to thank you all for your time. I have so many more questions for you, but the clock is the clock. Thank you, Dr. Patrick Rail, professor of history at Bowdoin College. His recent book, 88 Years, The Long Death of Slavery in the United States. Dr. Mary Freeman, assistant professor of New England history at the University of Maine. And Bob Green, a retired journalist, 8th-generation Mainer and Maine historian. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we turn to our panel of veterinarians. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.